When Bond left the bar, he walked purposefully along the pavement flanking the tree-lined boulevard towards his hotel a few hundred yards away. There were few people abroad, and the two men standing quietly under a tree on the opposite side of the boulevard looked out of place. Each wore a straw hat, and they had the appearance of a variety turn waiting for a bus on the way to the theatre. Incongruously, each dark, squat little figure was illuminated by a touch of bright colour. A bright red and a bright blue camera case slung from the shoulder. By the time Bond had taken in these details, he had come to within 50 yards of the two men. He was reflecting on the possibilities of cover when an extraordinary and terrible scene was enacted. Red Man seemed to give a short nod to Blue Man. Blue Man, and Bond could not see exactly as the trunk of a plane tree obscured his vision, bent forward and seemed to fiddle with his camera case. Then, with a blinding flash of white light, there was the ear-splitting crack of a monstrous explosion, and Bond, despite the protection of the tree trunk, was slammed down to the pavement by a bolt of hot air. He lay, gazing up at the sun, while the air went on twanging with the explosion, as if someone had hit the bass register of a piano with a sledgehammer. When, dazed and half-conscious, he raised himself on one knee, a ghastly rain of pieces of flesh and shreds of blood-soaked clothing fell on him. The road was a smoking crater. Of the two men in straw hats, there remained absolutely nothing. Bond felt himself starting to vomit. It was Mattis who got to him first, and by that time Bond was standing with his arm round the tree which had saved his life. He allowed Mattis to lead him off towards the Splendide, from which guests and servants were pouring in chattering fright. They managed to push through the throng and along the corridor to Bond's room. Mattis paused only to turn on the radio in front of the fireplace. Then, while Bond stripped off his blood-flecked clothes, Mattis sprayed him with questions.
"Merde, but you were lucky," he said when Bond had finished. "Clearly the bomb was intended for you. They intended to throw it and then dodge behind their tree. But it all came out the other way around. Never mind, we will discover the facts."
His eyes glittered.
"Now, get a drink and some lunch and a rest," he ordered Bond. "For me, I must get my nose quickly into this affair before the police have muddied the trail with their big black boots."
He turned off the radio and waved an affectionate farewell. Bond sat for a while by the window and enjoyed being alive. Bond had always been a gambler. He loved the dry riffle of the cards and the constant, unemphatic drama of the quiet figures round the green tables. He was amused by the impartiality of the roulette ball and of the playing cards, and their eternal bias. On this June evening, when Bond walked into the Salle Privée, it was with a sensation of confidence and cheerful anticipation that he changed 1,000,000 francs into plaque of 50,000 and took a seat next to the chef de partie at roulette table number 1. Bond borrowed the chef's card and studied the run of the ball since the session had started at 3 o'clock that afternoon. He always did this, although he knew that each turn of the wheel, each fall of the ball into a numbered slot, has absolutely no connection with its predecessor. He accepted that the game begins afresh each time the croupier picks up the ivory ball and gives one of the four spokes of the wheel a controlled twist clockwise. Bond decided to play one of his favourite gambits and back the first 24 numbers, each with the maximum, 100,000 francs. After 7 coups, he had won 6 times. His net profit was 400,000 francs. He kept off the table for the 8th throw. 0 turned up. This piece of luck cheered him further, and he decided to back the first and last dozens until he had lost 2. 10 throws later, he rose from the table, 1,000,000 francs to the good. Directly Bond had started playing in maximums, his game had become the centre of interest at the table. An American had shown more than the usual friendliness and pleasure at his winning streak. When Bond rose, he too pushed back his chair and called cheerfully across the table.
"Thanks for the ride. Guess I owe you a drink. Will you join me?"
Bond had a feeling that this might be the CIA man.
My name's Felix Leiter, said the American. Glad to meet you.
Mine's Bond. James Bond. Bond insisted on ordering Leiter's Haig and Haig on the rocks, and then he looked carefully at the barman. A dry martini, he said. One, in a deep champagne goblet.
Oui, monsieur.
Just a moment. Three measures of Gordon's, one of vodka, half a measure of Quina Lillet. Shake it very well until it's ice cold, then add a large thin slice of lemon peel. Got it?
Certainly, monsieur.
The barman seemed pleased with the idea. Gosh, that's certainly a drink, said Leiter. Bond laughed. When I'm concentrating, he explained, I never have more than one drink before dinner. But I do like that one to be large and very strong and very cold and very well made. This drink's my own invention. I'm going to patent it, when I can think of a good name. Leiter lowered his voice.
You better call it the Molotov cocktail after the one you tasted this afternoon.
Bond laughed. They sat down.
I'm glad to be working with you on this job, Leiter said. Our people are definitely interested. In fact, Washington's pretty sick. We're not running a show. Anyway, I'm under your orders, and I'm to give you any help you ask for.
I'm delighted you are, said Bond. I'd be grateful if you'd stick around the casino this evening. I've got an assistant, a Miss Lind, and I'd like to hand her over to you when I start playing. You won't be ashamed of her. She's a good-looking girl. He smiled at Leiter.
And you might mark Le Chiffre's two gunmen.
I can't imagine he'll try a roughhouse, but you never know. They parted company after arranging to see each other at the casino at around 10:30 or 11, the usual hour for the high tables to begin play. As Bond tied his thin, double-ended black satin tie, he paused for a moment and examined himself levelly in the mirror. His grey-blue eyes looked calmly back with a hint of ironical inquiry. He opened a drawer and took out a light chamois leather holster and slipped it over his left shoulder so that it hung about 3 inches below his armpit. He slipped his single-breasted dinner jacket over his heavy silk evening shirt, verified in the mirror that there was absolutely no sign of the flat gun under his left arm, gave a final pull at his narrow tie, and walked out of the door and locked it. When he turned at the foot of the short stairs towards the bar, he heard the lift door open behind him and a cool voice call, "Good evening." It was the girl. He had remembered her beauty exactly. He was not surprised to be thrilled by it again. Her dress was of black velvet, and there was a thin necklace of diamonds at her throat. Bond's heart lifted. "You look absolutely lovely. Business must be good in the radio world." She put her arm through his.
"Do you mind if we go straight into dinner?" she asked. "I want to make a grand entrance.
And the truth is, there's a horrible secret about black velvet. It marks when you sit down."
"Of course. Let's go straight in."
In her wake, he watched the heads of the diners turn to look at her. As they deciphered the maze of purple ink which covered the menu, Bond beckoned to the sommelier.
"A small carafe of vodka. Very cold," Bond ordered.
He said to her abruptly, "I can't drink the health of your new frock without knowing your Christian name."
"Vespa," she said.
Bond gave her a look of inquiry.
"I was born on a very stormy evening, according to my parents," she smiled.
"Some people like it, others don't. I'm just used to it."
"I think it's a fine name," said Bond.
An idea struck him. "Can I borrow it?" He explained about the special martini he had invented.
"The Vespa," he said. "It's very appropriate to the violet hour when my cocktail will now be drunk all over the world. We'll have one together when all this is finished. Win or lose. And now, here's luck for tonight, Vespa."
"Yes,"
said the girl quietly, as she held up her small glass and looked at him with a curious directness straight in the eyes. Then she leant impulsively towards him.
"I have some news for you from Mattis. He was longing to tell you himself. It's about the bomb."
Bon looked round, but there was no possibility of being overheard.
Tell me.
His eyes glittered with interest.
Apparently the men were part of a pool held in France for this sort of job, saboteurs, thugs and so on.
She took a sip of vodka.
The agent who briefed them gave them the two camera cases you saw. He told them that the blue case contained a very powerful smoke bomb. The red case was the explosive. They would escape under cover of the smoke. In fact, both cases contained an identical high-explosive bomb. The idea was to destroy you and the bomb throwers without trace.
Go on, said Bond, full of admiration for the ingenuity of the double cross.
Well, apparently the men decided to take no chances. It would be better, they thought, to touch off the smoke bomb first, and of course they both went up together. A third man was waiting behind the Splendide to pick his two friends up. When he saw what had happened, he assumed they had bungled. But the police picked up some fragments of the unexploded red bomb, and he was confronted with them. When he saw that they had been tricked, he started to talk. But there's nothing to link all this with Le Chiffre. Le Chiffre's name means absolutely nothing to the one who survived.
She finished her story just as the waiters arrived with caviar and a mound of hot toast.
Incidentally, Bond asked, how did you come to get mixed up in this affair? What section are you in? I'm personal assistant to Head of S, said Vesper. As it was his plan, he wanted his section to have a hand in the operation, and he asked M if I could go. I had to meet Matisse in Paris and come down with him. I've got a friend who is a vendeuse with Dior, and somehow she managed to borrow me this frock. Otherwise I couldn't possibly have competed with all these people.
She made a gesture towards the room.
The office was very jealous that I was to work with a 00. Of course you're our heroes. I was enchanted.
Bond frowned. It's not difficult to get a 00 number if you're prepared to kill people, he said. How do you like your caviar?
I'm loving my dinner. It seems a shame.
She stopped, warned by a cold look in Bond's eye. If it wasn't for the job, we wouldn't be here, he said. Suddenly he regretted the intimacy of their dinner and of their talk. Let's consider what has to be done, he said in a matter-of-fact voice. She listened to him coldly but with obedience.
Don't imagine that this is going to be any fun, her chief had said. He thinks of nothing but the job on hand, and while it's on, he's absolute hell to work for.
Don't fall for him. I don't think he's got much heart. Now, at a hint that they were finding pleasure together, Bond had suddenly turned to ice and had brutally veered away as if warmth were poison to him. She felt hurt and foolish. Then she gave a mental shrug and concentrated with all her attention on what he was saying. She would not make the same mistake again. Bond explained to Vesper just how baccarat is played. What happens is this. The banker announces an opening bank of 500,000 francs. The player next to the banker, or number one, can accept this bet and push his money out onto the table or pass it. Then number two has the right to take it, and if he refuses, then number three, and so on around the table. If no single player takes it all, the bet is offered to the table as a whole, and everyone chips in, including sometimes the spectators around the table, until the 500,000 is made up. When it gets to a million or two, it's often difficult to find a taker. At that moment, I shall always try and step in and accept the bet. In fact, I shall attack Le Chiffre's bank whenever I get a chance, until either I've bust his bank or he's bust me. It may take some time, but in the end one of us is bound to break the other, irrespective of the other players at the table. Bond drank some champagne and continued. The object of the game is to hold two or three cards which together count 9 points, or as nearly nine as possible. Court cards and tens count nothing, aces one each, any other card its face value. When the banker deals me my two cards, if they add up to eight or nine, they're a natural. In the end, Bond stubbed out his cigarette and called for the bill. It's the natural eights and nines that matter, and I must just see that I get more of them than he does. While telling the story of the game and anticipating the coming fight, Bond's face had lit up again. The prospect of at least getting to grips with Le Chiffre stimulated him and quickened his pulse. He seemed to have completely forgotten the brief coolness between them, and Vespa was relieved and entered into his mood. He paid the bill and gave a handsome tip to the sommelier. Vespa rose and led the way out of the restaurant and out onto the steps of the hotel. The big Bentley was waiting, and Bond drove Vespa over, parking as close to the entrance as he could. As they walked through the ornate anterooms, he hardly spoke. She saw his nostrils were slightly flared. In other respects, he seemed completely at ease, acknowledging cheerfully the greetings of the casino functionaries. Before they had penetrated very far into the main room, Felix Leiter detached himself from one of the roulette tables and greeted Bond as an old friend. After being introduced to Vespa Lind and exchanging a few remarks, Leiter said,
"Well, since you're playing baccarat this evening, will you allow me to show Miss Lind how to break the bank at roulette? Then perhaps we could come and watch you when your game starts to warm up."
Bond excused himself.
"You will be in excellent hands with my friend Felix Leiter."
He gave a short smile which embraced them both. Then he strolled slowly across the room between the thronged tables until he came to the top of the room where the broad baccarat table waited behind the brass rail. The chef de partie lifted the velvet-covered chain.
"I've kept number 6 as you wished, Monsieur Bond."
Bond sat down with a nod to the players on his right and left. Opposite him, the banker's chair was vacant. He glanced round the table. He knew most of the players by sight, but few of their names. At number 9 there was Lord Danvers, a distinguished but weak-looking man whose francs were presumably provided by his rich American wife, a middle-aged woman with the predatory mouth of a barracuda, who sat at number 3. At number 1, to the right of the bank, was a well-known Greek gambler who owned a profitable shipping line. Number 2 was Carmel Delane, the American film star with alimony from 3 husbands to burn. Numbers 4 and 5 were a Mr. and Mrs. Dupont. They both had a business-like look about them. Bond had just finished his sketchy summing up of the players when Le Chiffre, with the silence and economy of movement of a big fish, came through the opening in the brass rail and took his place directly opposite Bond in the banker's chair. As the croupier fitted 6 packs of cards with one swift, exact motion into the metal and wooden shoe, Le Chiffre said something quietly to him.
"Messieurs, mesdames, les jeux sont faits. Un banco de 500 000.
Le Chiffre crouched over the shoe. He gave it a short, deliberate slap to settle the cards. Then, with a thick white forefinger, he pressed gently on the pink tongue and slipped out the first card 6 inches or a foot towards the Greek at number 1. Then he slipped out a card for himself, then another for the Greek, then one more for himself. He sat immobile, not touching his own cards. He looked at the Greek's face. With his flat wooden spatula, like a long bricklayer's trowel, the croupier delicately lifted up the Greek's 2 cards. He dropped them with a quick movement so that they lay just before the Greek's pale hairy hands, which lay inert like 2 watchful pink crabs on the table. The 2 pink crabs scuttled out together, and the Greek gathered the cards into his wide left hand and cautiously bent his head so that he could see, in the shadow made by his cupped hand, the value of the bottom of the 2 cards. His face was quite impassive. Then he lifted his head and looked Le Chiffre in the eye.
"Non," said the Greek flatly.
Le Chiffre picked up his 2 cards and turned them face upwards on the table with a faint snap. They were a 4 and a 5, an undefeatable natural 9. He had won.
"Neuf à la banque,"
quietly said the croupier. With his spatula he faced the Greek's 2 cards.
"Et le 7,"
he said unemotionally, lifting up gently the corpses of the 7 and queen and slipping them through the wide slot in the table near his chair, to which all dead cards are consigned. The Greek pushed forward 5 plaques of 100,000, and the croupier added these to Le Chiffre's 500,000 plaque, which lay in the centre of the table. The croupier announced quietly,
"Un banco de million."
"Suivez,"
murmured the Greek, meaning that he exercised his right to follow up his lost bet. Bond lit a cigarette and settled himself in his chair. The Greek, after taking a third card, could achieve no better than a four to the bank seven.
Un banco de 2 millions, said the croupier.
The players on Bond's left remained silent.
Banco, said Bond. Le Chiffre looked incuriously at him, the whites of his eyes, which showed all round the irises, lending something impassive and doll-like to his gaze. The other players sensed a tension between the two gamblers, and there was silence as Le Chiffre fingered the four cards out of the shoe. The croupier slipped Bond's two cards across to him. Bond, still with his eyes holding Le Chiffre's, reached his right hand out a few inches, glanced down very swiftly, then as he looked up again impassively at Le Chiffre, with a disdainful gesture he tossed the cards face upwards on the table. They were a four and a five, an unbeatable nine. There was a little gasp of envy from the table, and the players to the left of Bond exchanged rueful glances at their failure to accept the 2 million franc bet. With a hint of a shrug, Le Chiffre slowly faced his own two cards and flicked them away with his fingernail. They were two valueless knaves. Le baccarat, intoned the croupier, as he spaded the thick chips over the table to Bond. Bond slipped them into his right-hand pocket. His face showed no emotion, but he was pleased with the success of his first coup and with the outcome of the silent clash of wills across the table. As the game went on, Bond looked over the spectators leaning on the high brass rail round the table. He soon saw Le Chiffre's two gunmen. They stood behind and to either side of the banker. The one more or less behind Le Chiffre's right arm was tall and funereal in his dinner jacket. Bond guessed that he would kill without interest or concern, and that he would prefer strangling. The other man was short and very dark, with a flat head covered with thickly greased hair. A chunky Malacca cane with a rubber tip hung on the rail beside him. His mouth hung vacantly half open and revealed very bad teeth. He wore a heavy black moustache, and the backs of his hands on the rail were matted with black hair. Naked, Bond supposed, he would be an obscene object. The game continued uneventfully, but with a slight bias against the bank. Le Chiffre showed no trace of emotion. He continued to play like an automaton, never speaking except when he gave instructions in a low aside to the croupier at the opening of each new bank. It was at 1:10 by Bond's watch when the whole pattern of play suddenly altered. The Greek at number one was still having a bad time. He had lost the first coup of 500,000 francs and the second. He passed the third time, leaving a bank of 2 million. Carmel Delane at number two refused it. So did Lady Danvers at number three. The Dupont looked at each other. Banco, said Mrs. Dupont, and promptly lost to the banker's natural eight.
Un banco de 4 millions, said the croupier.
Banco, said Bond, pushing out a wad of notes.
Again he fixed Le Chiffre with his eye. Again he gave only a cursory look at his two cards.
No,
he said. He held a marginal five. The position was dangerous. Le Chiffre turned up a knave and a four. He gave the shoe another slap. He drew a three.
Sept à la banque, said the croupier. Et cinq,
he added as he tipped Bond's losing cards face upwards.
Un banco de 8 millions.
Suivi, said Bond, and lost again to a natural nine.
In two coups, he had lost 12 million francs. By scraping the barrel, he had just 16 million francs left, exactly the amount of the next banco. Suddenly, Bond felt the sweat on his palms. Like snow in sunshine, his capital had melted. With the covetous deliberation of the winning gambler, Le Chiffre was tapping a light tattoo on the table with his right hand. Bond looked across into the eyes of murky basalt.
Do you want the full treatment? They seemed to ask.
Suivi, Bond said softly.
His mouth felt suddenly dry. He looked up and saw Vesper and Felix Leiter standing where the gunman with the stick had stood. He did not know how long they had been standing there. Leiter looked faintly worried, but Vespa smiled encouragement at him. He heard a faint rattle on the rail behind him and turned his head. The battery of bad teeth under the black moustache gaped vacantly back at him.
Le jeu est fait, said the croupier,
and the two cards came slithering towards him over the green baize. He glanced at the cards. Then he looked again. It was nearly as bad as it could have been. The king of hearts and an ace. The ace of spades. A card. He still kept all emotion out of his voice. Le chiffre faced his own two cards. He had a queen and a black five. He looked at Bond and pressed out another card with a wide forefinger. The table was absolutely silent. The croupier slipped it over to Bond. It was a good card, the five of hearts. He now had a count of six, and Le Chiffre a count of five. The odds were on Bond's side, but now it was Le Chiffre who looked across into Bond's eyes and hardly glanced at the card as he flicked it face upwards on the table. It was, unnecessarily, the best. A four, giving the bank a count of nine. He had won. Bond was beaten and cleaned out.